are going to take a break from the election here for the afternoon show. We actually have an afternoon show that I'm really excited about today. This is Sarah. I'll be here until 6 p.m. on the air. But I'm joined in the studio right now by Michael O'Hara. Hi, Michael.
Howdy.
And Michael and I are going to talk a little bit about the 10% Challenge, a program that that is sponsored by the City of Hudson here, but part of a wider network of challenges throughout the country, throughout New York State.
Well, there's efforts like this going on all over the world, actually. So it's part of a larger idea that's been spread quite a ways.
So Michael O'Hara is the City of Hudson Energy Advisor, and he has just launched the outreach component of the campaign that he's working on, which means that it's time for you and I to know what it is that he's doing. And I think you can probably introduce it far better than I. Let's start by just kind of talking about what it is.
Sure. The idea is to support people in their efforts to reduce their energy use. The structure that we've set up is to set a challenge in place to ask people to say to themselves, can I reduce my energy use over the course of a year by 10%? Now, we picked 10% because in tests and studies done in other parts of the country, it's been found that by behavior changes alone, you can reduce your energy use by somewhere between 5 and 15%. So 10% is doable, and it's something that still does ask people to stretch a little bit. It's not insignificant. And the idea further goes into support people in their efforts to accomplish what they have now said they were going to do. When you say you're going to do something, when you set an objective, there's a little part of your brain that opens up to suggestions about how to accomplish that. If, for example, you've decided that you need tires on the car, all of a sudden the newspaper ads about tires attract your eye, where you would have passed them by otherwise if you didn't have any need for tires. So similarly, having decided that, yes, I'm going to do this, I'm going to reduce my energy use, now when my program sends out an email, posts on Facebook, sends out a message by any other means, all of a sudden you pay attention to it. It's not just junk mail that National Grid or New York State is sending out or putting a TV ad in that you could disregard. Now you've said, well, gee, this is something I need to pay attention to. So the two go hand in hand. The information that will be coming out of the program and the dedication of the people who are pledged to reduce their energy use make for a more effective program.
It is. It's actually very interesting. The psychological power of the collective pledge. And this month is also National Novel Writers Month or something. Or there's this novel writing challenge going on that I have a couple of friends who are participating in, where they've all pledged to write a novel this month or start one or something. I actually know very little about it except for that it's only similar in that. And that there really is something effective about not only saying you're going to do something, but then feeling like you're part of a community of people who are trying to do something together and alone.
Exactly.
And what that does to your the probability of you actually seeing something through.
Indeed. I mean, that's well understood in management. This has been part of the sort of normal consciousness of how to get the maximum performance out of a team is to help them set an objective that is doable and measurable, and then the manager's job is to help them do what they have all committed to do. It's not a new concept in that sense of the word. It's just new in this way of expressing it, of utilizing it as a way to assist people in doing something like this that is understood by everybody to be a good thing. But if you're just sort of living your life and going about your daily business, and you're not focused on this particular aspect, it just doesn't come up. It's not part of your daily consciousness.
And then what the infrastructure of this program? There's an educational component that's going on. How are you actually connecting with people? Is there more than you? Like, what does this look like in terms of kind of a people infrastructure?
Well, at 4:15 today, I'm going to be on the radio, so that's part of it. But in addition to that, I'm making presentations at pre-existing groups, churches and the Rotary Club and the Chamber of Commerce, any of the organizations that have a regular meeting. I would love to be invited to speak at it, and we'll be offering them an idea, which is to create subcommittees within their already existing organizations that could meet together to support each other among people that they already know and can help share ideas. How did this particular insulation, this contractor, this particular way of doing something work? Well, I tried it a little different way, and be able to increase their collective knowledge, even by communicating amongst these groups in themselves. And a couple of the church groups that I've spoken to have expressed interest in setting up in just that way. The other way that we're reaching out to people is through the Common Council members themselves. I made a presentation the other day to the Hudson Common Council members, and they are all committed to be part of the program now and are themselves reaching out to their constituents. While they're out campaigning in many cases, they also had a packet of my brochures, which they were able to pass along to people, along with the flyers that they were using to talk about their own candidacies. So in a lot of different ways, it's not a big organization at this point. The organization is myself and my assistant, Susan Hoffman, and we work out of the office in my home. It's right now funded by grant money that I helped the city of Hudson apply for last year. When they got it, I was hired to implement. So it's a small effort on our part, but which I think will be passed along in a viral kind of way, including the efforts I'm making on Facebook. I hope that it'll reach at least 150 families by next March. That's my objective, which is about 10% of the households in Hudson. And once those people look back over the course of however many months and look at the energy savings that they've achieved, their positive impression of it can be conveyed to their friends and family, and will spread from there.
So the first time I heard you talk about this program was at a presentation that we were both at Club Helsinki that had to do with nuclear energy, and I remember in the question and answer session afterwards, we started talking a little bit about specifically measuring the energy used when we're on the internet, and there was just kind of informal conversation happening about this, and I remember being kind of struck by your response, because you were talking not only about how much energy we're using when we're on the internet, but also incorporating into that measurement all of the activities that we are, all the energy intensive activities that we're not engaged in because we're using the internet, and kind of figuring out how to create some kind of algorithm to include that too. And I'm curious to hear a little bit about the complexity of actually measuring, like how are we measuring our 10% that we're saving, and I'm sure I have a feeling this is something that you could answer for like the next 2 hours, but
well, I could, but the simple answer is that we're making it as simple as possible, because we don't expect people to do what is called a life cycle analysis of their entire life. Once you really get into this, yes, you can aim for that, and there's university studies about the effect of what does it take to make a ballpoint pen. Where did the material come from? How was it refined? How was it shipped? How was it packaged? How long does it last? And when it's at the end of its useful life, is it recycled or reused? There's you can get very deep into these things. But for the purposes of the Hudson 10% Energy Challenge, what we're asking people to do is pay attention to those things which are more easily measurable, such as your electric bill. Every month you get one of them. If you're connected to the natural gas grid, every month you get a bill for that as well. if you're using fuel oil or wood or some other bulk fuel for your home heating, it's a bit more tricky to try and track that at all, because you get these big lumps of delivery two or three times a year. But for the electric and gas, it's actually pretty simple. What we do is we give people a chart, such as the radio audience can't see, but which I'm holding up to show to my host here, which goes across the one axis with the months of the year, and on the other axis, in this particular case, kilowatt hours, showing how much, and you can plot it, showing how many kilowatt hours showed up on your bill in a given month. And, of course, you can go online with National Grid, our local carrier here in Columbia, for most of the people in Columbia County, and get the last 2 years of your energy usage in a little chart in a matter of a couple of minutes. If also you have a file cabinet with the old bills, you can just take it off of there. But plotting that over the last couple of years, you can see the seasonal variation in your electric use. Or with the chart we have for the natural gas usage, the axis along the left-hand side is plotted with therms, which is a reflection of what volume of gas you used. Now, of course, seasonally...
Therm? That's the volume? That's the measurement?
That's correct. Huh. It's a multiple of cubic feet. I think it's actually 7.5 cubic feet of natural gas. But that's the standard increment on your natural gas bill. So you can see that, of course, between June and November, there's quite a bit of seasonal variation in the gas usage. So what we're asking people to do is to look back a few years so that you can say, well, what's this November versus last November versus the November before that? And you can start to see patterns there, and you can start to say, well, how is my this November going to be affected by the behavior changes that I'm going to implement this month? Because I'm going to get, for example, I'm going to fill out a form and get a free home energy audit. The home energy audit is paid for by New York State. You just have to fill out a form, send it in to the right address in Albany. They send you back a voucher that you use to hire a certified contractor to come out and do the work. Having understood by the report that these people give you that you have leaks around your windows, you run out and buy a package of weather stripping at your local hardware store, and by the actually going into December, let's say, you were to take this action in early November, you could very well start to see a difference between this December's bill and the previous December's. So that's the sort of way that you can respond to it and see the results of your actions. I like to think of this as being analogous to a certain extent to Weight Watchers. Mm-hmm. Those of you who have had your own experience or know anybody that's gone through that, it's a program that depends on feedback. That the participants go into their meeting every week and they listen to a lecture about good eating habits and exercise, but then they stand on the scale. That's the moment of truth. Having decided in the midst of your Weight Watchers program that you want to lose a certain amount of weight, let's say 10 pounds, if you step on the scale a few weeks, a half a pound, oops, you're going in the wrong direction. But if, on the other hand, you get in and step on the scale and you're down a half a pound, well, this encourages you and you keep going in that direction. So this is the idea in terms of feedback. Chart the results of your last couple of years, put it up on the refrigerator, have your kids look at it, and probably, depending on the age of your kids, have them do the plotting in the first place.
I will say, I'm looking at these charts right now, that examples of I don't know if of a commercial storefront's natural gas usage history over 3 years, and it is plotted month by month, and then an electricity usage history, and it actually is they're kind of friendly graphs.
Colored pencil.
It is kind of amazing the kind of immediate power in being in seeing it concrete like this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's a fundamental tool that we ask people to do first. When they join up with the program, we have these sheets already set up with the right graph and level of increments, and we ask people to download them off the web. They're PDFs, and you plot them with your own colored pencil. Or if you're computer oriented, like I am, of course you can do the same thing just with your Excel spreadsheet and have it be even prettier when you print them out.
These are pretty pretty.
Yeah. And there are a couple of different outfits that provide online automation of the same sort of tracking process. You give them your utility bill information and the access code that you use to get on National Grid, in our case. And every month, you get an email from these folks that says, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, your energy use for this month for gas and electric is X. And it compares with your previous month of the previous year, let's say last November, as this much delta. It's 2% mm-hmm. high, 3% low. And it compares with the rest of the people in your region in the following way. You're higher than average, lower than average. So without any even work on your part, it gives you this information, plus the tracking of how you compare with everybody else that you wouldn't otherwise know.
Right. And then you have a whole bunch of props here.
I do. this is radio.
They're distracting me. They look so cool.
The first thing I'll show you is a energy tracking device from made by an outfit called Belkin, which some of your computer users might recognize as makers of routers and such. The one part of it plugs into the wall, and as Sarah can see, there's a plug on the back part of it, into which you plug the jack for whatever device you want to measure. So attached to it on a 3-foot-long cord is a little display meter. So having plugged your coffee maker or radio or TV into this device, you can then press one of three buttons and understand how many kilowatts this device would consume instantaneously. And if you leave it on for an hour, it'll tell you, of course, how many kilowatt hours, mm-hmm. which is the load times the amount of time it's been used. And you can also program it to tell you how much money that would have cost you.
Wow.
Based on the local electricity costs. Here in New York State, we pay about 17 cents a kilowatt hour. And then this little emblem of a globe on the one side would, when pressed, show you how much in the way of a carbon output this would result in for that amount of time for that much power.
Wow. Now, what a neat gadget.
I got it at Lowe's. It's, I think, $15 or $20. It's inexpensive. It's cute. And with the wire, I have another one of these gadgets that doesn't have the sort of extension, the difference between the plug and the display. And so if you were to plug this into something that was kind of behind a cabinet or something, it's a pain in the neck to read it. So this is easy.
Are there certain things that you think we would plug in that would totally surprise us, things that we think either don't take, that are relatively low intensive, that we would plug in and be shocked by the number?
And be surprised at mm-hmm. how big that number is. Well, one of the things that I read about, actually almost a year ago at this point, was an article in the New York Times that pointed out that the set-top boxes that many people use in coordination with cable TV use a lot of electricity. Especially with the very popular function of the digital video recorder, the DVR, sometimes known by the brand name of, what is it? It's escaping me right now. But it allows you to record television programs.
Like TiVo.
TiVo, that's the brand name. These little things have a hard disk drive in them. And if you listen to it carefully, you can hear that darn thing spinning all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So these darn things use more electricity than your refrigerator, which is otherwise a big energy culprit in most homes. So
if you leave your phone charger plugged in when you're not using it?
Well,
is that a rumor?
Oh, it's not. Touch the phone charger, even though your phone is not itself plugged into it. And if it feels just a little bit warm,
it's working.
It's working, and it's a transformer. It's taking the AC current out of the jack and transforming it into DC current at a lower voltage for your electrical instrument, whatever that is, the phone or your radio or what have you. And yes, that uses electricity that is sometimes referred to as vampire electricity, because it's just sort of just sitting there sucking the current and to no use. It's translating that that energy, in the case of your phone not being plugged in, just into heat, which dissipates into the atmosphere and does nobody any good. One of our sister organizations, the folks in Connecticut who were doing a similar program, published a really neat description for children at Halloween time, which encouraged them to turn out all the lights in the house and search for lights that are still on, and they called it a vampire hunt. And this this was aimed at getting the kids to participate. So you go into the other room, and of course you're working with the kids to make sure they're safe, but you see the little lights that are associated with any of the devices in your home that are on all the time. If you have anything in your house, for example, that operates by remote control, the device, like a TV or a radio, has to really be on a little bit in order to listen for the click of your remote.
Ooh.
So the solution to vampires is to either unplug the device, the charger, or in some cases, especially if you have a couple of different devices that are in the same place, like the TV and the set-top box or your stereo system, is to plug in a power strip, one plug with a bunch of outlets along it and a little switch to make it easy for you to just at the end of your TV watching evening or radio listening, just to click the switch and it's really, really off.
So for folks who are just tuning in, we are talking about the 10% challenge. I'm here with Michael O'Hare. We're talking about the 10% challenge, which is an invitation to join with your neighbors in this program that both supports people and also informs people about how to save energy, save money, and improve the environment. I want to talk light bulbs. I want to make sure we talk light bulbs at some point.
Gotcha. Let me wrap up my little energy measurement device talk here by saying that I have a bunch of these and I loan them out because this is not something you really need to have around all the time. What I encourage people to do is to identify the devices that they'd like to learn more about. I for example, discovered that my coffee machine uses 800 watts.
And that's
so
a lot.
If I leave the darn thing on accidentally, it really racks up the bills. So I make a pot of coffee and I put it into a thermos and I turn the coffee pot off. So just as an example, test out a few of your obvious culprits for energy consumption in the house. Find write that down and say, gee, this particular old refrigerator that I have in the basement, which I keep a case of beer in. Perhaps this is costing me more than it's worth, and I could just put a can or two in my regular fridge and not use all this electricity. This is all too common.
I'm totally just like scanning through my list of vampires at home. I think I have some really bad ones. I live right now in a cold attic, and I have this horrible thing that I'm using, which is like an electric mattress pad heater.
Not so bad.
Really?
Not so bad.
I feel like it must be killing me, but I also can't.
Well, just run it before you get into bed, and then turn it off once you get into bed, and then you're not sort of zapping yourself with.
Do you think that one wouldn't
energy.
that number wouldn't shock me?
I'll loan this to you, and you can find out.
I think I'd like that.
See how shocked you are.
Okay, let's talk light bulbs very quickly because there are so many in this room.
Indeed. Okay. What I'm showing to the radio audience, or to Sarah at least, is a sample of three different kinds of energy-saving light bulbs. The one that everybody's familiar with is what looks like a little tiny cone of soft ice cream. Now, the compact fluorescent technology is an innovative way to compress the amount of space that a fluorescent tube that we've been familiar with for 50 years now, that is normally 2 or 4 feet long and in a straight line. So if you twist that around, you can make some of the same amount of light in a smaller space, and with the proper fixture, you just screw it in like the old-fashioned incandescent light bulb. But to use one quarter of the electricity that that incandescent light bulb would have used. The if the appearance of the swirl on the top makes you hungry because of its resemblance to ice cream, then I did bring a couple of GE Energy Smart soft white bulbs that to the casual observer look like a regular incandescent bulb because they're covered in a little plastic covering, which has the same appearance of the same one that you've been familiar with for so long.
But they're still squiggly and squiggly. Well,
if you look close, you can see the coil inside, yes. But this also addresses a concern on the part of some people. It's a tough, slightly flexible piece of plastic on the outside. If somebody is sort of worried about the very, very small amount of mercury, which has to be included in the fluorescent technology. It's also in your straight tubes, by the way. It's not just in the curlies. Then you could comfort yourself, and especially in more vulnerable locations where you're afraid a child might knock over a lamp or something like that, by buying one of the lamps that is quite securely. I mean, you could just bang this on the table. It might break the fluorescent tube inside, but the outer covering of it would remain intact. Now, that being said, the amount of mercury in a typical compact fluorescent is really not a lot to worry about, especially, and for something to think about, if you eat tuna fish. If you consume a can of tuna fish over the course of a week, this is several times the amount of mercury that you would get, even if you intentionally broke a compact fluorescent bulb and inhaled deeply over it, just to get the maximum effect. As
are
if
you
were
our
huffing glue.
Our fears disproportionate.
Yes. I have a friend who is a world famous lighting designer who has sort of argued with me in a friendly way over this point. And my feeling is that the likelihood of breaking a light bulb of any sort, never mind, you know, whatever technology, is relatively low. So you're likely to only encounter it, you know, once in many years, if you're somewhat careful, and that the amount that of mercury that you're likely to expose yourself to even then is less than your tuna fish consumption is likely to give you. And the reduction in power usage that these represent, three-quarters reduction in your power usage for your lighting, reduces, therefore, the amount of coal-fired power plant emissions that you could displace. And every pound of coal that you burn has mercury in it. It's just a natural byproduct of coal combustion. So the angle that you know, you want to reduce your personal exposure, yes, it's not likely to be enough to really, well, you don't want to have any mercury at all, but just in all the ways that you can reduce our total society exposure to it, reducing your energy use by whatever means is the way to go. Now, let's move on to the other technology. In my other hand, I have a light bulb that looks a little less sort of familiar. At the top, it looks like a classic incandescent bulb, but it's surrounded by a little metal framework that helps to dissipate any heat generated by the device. This is the LED technology. LED technology has been around for a while, but they've only recently figured out how to make white LEDs. They've had red ones and green ones and orange ones, and as a matter of fact, a whole lot of the traffic lights, the red and green traffic signals that you see at corners these days, are using LED lights. They're used in cars as stoplights in the back of the car. There's a lot of applications for LEDs, and in flashlights, they're just super because they use very little electricity, and it's ideal for a battery-powered device. So inside homes, though, they're just getting to the point where they're usable as kind of regular, replaceable fixtures. You screw this into any light socket, and you're good to go. It puts out a nice white light, and it's dimmable, which most compact fluorescent lamps are not, although you can buy special ones that can be dimmed. So this, if you had, let's say, a baby gift to give, and you wanted to go and present the proud parents something that would last for their child, giving them an LED lamp like this, it would still be working when that kid gets out of college, because they last so long. So in this particular case, this cost me $12 over the course of the next 20 years. that $12 makes the cost per usage of this just absurdly low. But you have to think long range, because it is relative. By the way we think about light fixtures these days, this is still relatively expensive.
That is very cool. I'm looking at the brochure right here, and just because I know we're in drive time, it's just almost 5 p.m., and a lot of listeners are probably in their cars right now. One of the bullet points on here, how can I get started, is drive slower. You can improve gas mileage around 10% by going 5 miles per hour slower on the highway.
Oh, yeah.
God, that's easy.
I hope so. That's part of the behavior changes that that people can adopt. The other tracking mechanism that one could have, and I should probably make up a chart for that to be downloadable, are things like the gas consumption, fuel consumption. So if you have a relatively regular commute has the certain predictability to it, then that would be a meaningful tracking measurement.
So we've got about two more minutes. I want to make sure people know how to learn more, how to find you. I do think it's a really powerful thing to say that that together we can embark on this voluntary and collective lowering of consumption. I think that I've been in just like way too many conversations about whether or not an individual can make a difference. I think it's become really clear, especially recently in the States, around the world, that individually, together, we can do quite a bit. And especially when you break it down to these kind of like uber simple things, there's just kind of no excuse, even if you're have got a more defeatist mindset, you can still change your light bulb.
A purely selfish point of view, even if you're not out to save the world, this is good for you. So do it for yourself, do it for your family, do it for the planet.
So Michael's telling us that he can help answer our questions about what kind of products are going to help us. What are some of the first steps you can take in your house, in your car, etc. How do people follow up with you?
They go to our website, which spelled out is Hudson10%Challenge.org. That's not using the number 10 or the percent sign. Just spell out all those words. Hudson10%Challenge.org, or call 518-828-4369. That's 828-4369.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to get this recording archived if you want to send it out. And then we were just recording a PSA in the other room, but it would be neat to have a kind of a series of PSAs. If each couple of weeks there was a different...
A little tip, something, some bit of information that would be useful.
Yeah, because all at once it can get kind of dizzying. I want to borrow one of those... what are they called?
the
measurement gadget gizmo.
Good. Great. That'd be fine.
Well, thank you so much. You are listening to the WGXC Afternoon Show. We are talking right now about the Hudson 10% Energy Challenge. You can join us in saving energy, saving money, saving the world, all at the same time. If you stay tuned, we're going to be joined by Gideon Crevachet and Melinda Brothen in here. We're going to talk about the conference that just happened at the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College last weekend, and listen to some of the lectures that those of us who couldn't make it took place there. We're going to broadcast an introductory lecture and another one, truth telling in an age of democracy without facts. So stay tuned.